Welcome to the 33rd episode of Cartoon Avatars. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett. And on this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation between Zach Weinberg and I talking about Zach's endeavors into the documentary world, which caused a little bit of a Twitter shitstorm this week when he was talking about potentially documenting the homelessness problem in New York, in particular around Chelsea, where he lives. And we talk about what he's actually trying to accomplish here and the outrage that came from him suggesting this online. And so we go through that. And then on the back half of the episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation Zach and I have with Kate Ryder, who's the founder and CEO of Maven. In full disclosure, my fiance works at Maven. She has been there for 3 years and now is leading product marketing for them. And so Kate and I talk a little bit about that. I actually weirdly lived in Kate's house at the very beginning of the pandemic, which is an interesting story. So we kind of go through all of that, but it's a healthcare focused maternity benefits company, or women's health company. And so we go through kind of the state of healthcare and benefits and insurance and a lot of the stuff that Zach knows very well. And so talking to her about all that and leading in a world post Roe v. Wade for women's health and all of those things. So a really interesting conversation there. I think one of the things that I wanted to hit, and I've never done anything like this before, but after we recorded the news on Thursday broke that Adobe was acquiring Figma, which is a design company that I know somewhat well. And so figured, given it's in the software world, given it's kind of what I focus on, although I've never spent time with Figma specifically, I figured it might be interesting. It's a $20 to $22 billion acquisition by Adobe. And there was I posted a little bit about it on Twitter, and that got people up in arms in different corners. And so I figured I would give at least a little bit of an overview on it, given it's been slow on the news lately. We haven't done a bunch of news topics recently, and this has sort of been my competency of what I wake up thinking about. And so I figured I would just kind of talk through that from my perspective. And so also I've never done this kind of the radio talk show host version of this, where I'm just kind of talking into a microphone here, but maybe it's something we can do if topics are actually interesting enough. So for people that don't know, as I mentioned, it was a $20 billion price for Figma. There was another, I think it was 6 million in RSUs, restricted stock units. So that's kind of incentive comp for the Figma team. And so if you do the math on a price per share basis, I think it roughly nets out to about another $2 billion. And so it's $22 billion in total compensation for this company. It's the largest private software acquisition that's ever occurred. It was disclosed that Adobe is paying 50 times end of year annual recurring revenue. I think most people that listen to this will know what annual recurring revenue is, but that is, I mean, the highest public companies right now are trading at 25 times end of year revenue. And so revenue, I guess in this case, we can do a little bit of a back of the envelope math here. If they're trading at 50 times ARR for end of year, I don't know, maybe that means it's 70 times end of year revenue, which is just a crazy multiple. I mean, we saw a lot of those a couple months back, but an insanely high multiple there. The deal was half cash and half stock. They disclosed a little bit of information about Figma's business. So it's roughly going to end the year at $400 million in annual recurring revenue. That would be up from $200 million. Roughly, they're growing over 100%. The business is cash flow positive, and they have over 150% net dollar retention, which is really, really impressive. I think that would put it in the top, I don't know, five public companies or something like that. This would be a public business today, today, most likely, if the markets were open. And so I think this has been regarded for a while as the top one, if not top two or three private software companies over the last couple of years. And so really, really impressive outcome for the business as well. Adobe is a roughly, it was before the acquisition, roughly $150 billion business. It closed down 17% on the news just because this was a very high price to pay. I think Adobe trades at something like 10 times end of year revenue, and they are paying roughly, I don't know, 60 or 70 times end of year revenue for this. And it's going to be whatever that is, 20 over 150 of their entire entire business value is going to Figma. So it's yeah, I think the market didn't love it. I happen to think it's I think it's a brilliant move by Adobe in some ways. I got into a little bit of a debate about what the definition of strategic is on Twitter, but I think this is a really strategic acquisition for Adobe for a few reasons. So in terms of what Figma actually does, and it's important to kind of understand that and what they got right in particular from my vantage point. And again, I'm not an expert, but I do know a little bit about this and a little bit about the market. And so what Figma does, for people that don't know, it's a design software company. And so the two things that they do well is they do they combine two components together. So they combined wireframing, which is kind of low resolution mockups, so to speak, and then prototyping, which is much more higher resolution. And they did that in a multiplayer way, right? They did that originally in the browser. And design and product, you know, there's been books written about this, and it's been a big trend for a while. But as you think about what design for products is, it really is any digital product that you touch today and how it actually gets built, what it looks like, what the flow is, the simplicity, the elegance, all of that stuff is what design is, right? And so it could be the mobile app on your phone, it could be the website you visit, it could be the SaaS product you log into, it could be whatever it is, right? This is the system where B2B companies that are building products, it's where they work. Now, what Figma got right, and what I give the team over there just like an immense amount of credit, they got a bunch of things right, right? The business was founded, I think, 10 years ago. Dylan Field, a really interesting guy. I've been bugging him for the last few months to come on the podcast, and now I know why. He's been, well, I don't know, at least why I can tell myself that he's been reticent to come on. We'll see after this acquisition if he's more willing to do it. I think this is obvious, but building this into Adobe's business has been designed for the longest time, right? And what Figma got right in a unique way was one, building this for multiplayer lets everyone collaborate in one place so that you're building a holistic product rather than individual components that need to be like retrofit back together. And so if you think about it, like the difference between Microsoft Word and Google Docs. Microsoft Word is an individual file. In this multiplayer world, individual files don't exist, right? And that allows, there's trade-offs that exist with that where you can't work offline in the same way that you can with Microsoft Word, right? You download it to your desktop and you can work on it. But what this allows you to do, and what Figma nailed particularly well, is both combining these two elements of the low resolution wireframing and the high resolution prototyping into a single product, and then doing that in the browser, right, where you have to actually go to basically a website for the application to work, and building it from a first principle standpoint to be truly multiplayer. And they did that in a really, really elegant way. And so there were competitors that did different components of this stuff. For a while, once upon a time, and I know a lot of people still use these two businesses, but Sketch was more desktop oriented and wireframing, and Envision was another company more desktop oriented for prototyping. Both those companies have now built cloud products, and they've ultimately, I think Sketch now has gone from wireframing, kind of the low resolution stuff, into prototyping, which is the more high resolution stuff. And Envision, I know, has done the opposite of that. What Figma did really well was doing this all from the start, right? And kind of building this browser-based product for multiplayer. And that's just a uniquely difficult thing to do. These applications are particularly complicated, and it's really hard to both retrofit a desktop product into the cloud, right? And I've never done it, but so I've been told. It's hard to do that. And so taking what a product that you work on your individual desktop and building it from a first principle standpoint, or from a way that's very functional into the browser, is just a difficult thing to do, right? And then also building a multiplayer is a really hard thing to do when you're retrofitting an application, right? And so I know Adobe has tried at different points in time. This is a major element of their business, right? And so they haven't been totally lost that they need to figure out how to go from the single player, me working on my desktop, doing design, right? And then passing off the individual file and all of that to the world of multiplayer collaboration, right? And it's something that they've tried. But at the end of the day, no one that is the cool kids that exist in the world or that exist in Silicon Valley or at companies, like anyone that's sophisticated and forward thinking in their approach, they just weren't starting on Adobe's products, right? Which represents a existential risk to the company in terms of their ability to exist for the next 5 to 10 years, right? And so if everyone's growing up, the 19-year-olds that are in school and are learning design, the 22-year-olds that are going to work at Stripe or Coinbase or whatever it is, aren't actually learning, aren't learning Adobe anymore, that represents an existential risk to their business. And it was because of this design decisions that Figma made that allowed them to succeed at the expense of Adobe and some of the other players in the space, right? And so that we can debate what the ultimate value of Figma should be, but to some extent, this is Adobe waving the white flag saying, hey, the future of collaboration, the future of multi-person design within B2B is Figma, right? And that's where we're going to build around. Now, from an organizational standpoint, Dylan's going to operate as the CEO of Figma. And my understanding is autonomy was an important thing. We'll see. I know a bunch of designers on Twitter felt like this was going to be the death of Figma. I know that is typically the way that acquisitions work, is that suddenly the talent starts to bleed out a little bit there. But I don't know. I don't want to presuppose what's actually going to happen from Figma and Adobe's standpoint here. Now, I guess it's interesting. The other thing that Figma has in their product set that is new and early and growing is this whiteboarding tool, which they call FigJam, right? And it's kind of this collaborative whiteboarding thing that allows you to kind operate in space and to work remotely in the same way that I might have a whiteboard up here. And if someone were in the room with me mocking things up, you can kind of work in an unstructured way. There's a bunch of competitors in that space. Miro and Mural are the independent players that I think Miro's last round was, I don't know, $15 billion or something like that. And Mural's been a really successful company as well. Vision's built out a product here. Microsoft's building out a product here. So that's a competitive space. But you can imagine, like, as you sort of think through the design life cycle, you sort of start with this very unstructured whiteboard, right? And then you start to mock it up from a prototyping, mock it up from a wireframing standpoint. And then you go into prototyping that actual product. And Figma kind of accomplishes all of those things together in an integrated kind of first principles way. So So I guess the question is, why would Figma do this, right? I saw different people online sort of saying Figma should have been or could have been a $50 billion public company, right? Which I don't necessarily disagree with. So a few things. One, the price was very, very compelling, right? 50 times end of year ARR represents, I think it's the second largest software acquisition price ever, and maybe the largest for a private company or something. I'm probably off a little bit on that, but it's just the gravity of those numbers, a $20 billion business with $2 billion of additional RSUs to be spread among the employee base. That cannot be overstated, just the quantum of those dollars, right? And Figma came out and said after all this that they had a $16.5 billion TAM as they calculate it, right? Adobe is paying more for this company than the stated TAM by the company that they're actually buying, right? And so it's just a big number, right? And I think that represents how strategic Adobe thinks this is, but also just the number of people that are going to do very, very financially well on this. And I know I've been involved in some of these acquisition discussions. It's always bittersweet. It's bittersweet for the founder and CEO. It's bittersweet for the board members. This company caught lightning in a bottle, right? And so I know that there are probably some investors that wanted to that were saying, holy shit, this is such a big price, like, and our returns are going to be so good here. And then there are other investors saying, this is a once in a lifetime investment for me. I want to see how far this can go, right? And so I'm sure within the boardroom, it was divided in different camps of like whether or not they should roll forward or not. Ultimately, investors in general they have multiple shots on goal, right? And their entire success isn't going to be necessarily tied to this individual investment in the same way that the founder and the team here is, right? And so what I've seen happen in most of these boardroom settings is ultimately everyone kind of defers to the founder, right? And so I can't suppose what was going through Dylan's mind at this. Obviously, he's become a billionaire a few times over here, and he's a fascinating guy. As I've never met him personally, but as I've sort of known him in the industry, I know he has a lot of interests, and I think he's going to be an influential figure in the tech ecosystem for a long, long time. He started this company at 20. Now I think he's only 30. So we're going to be hearing about him for a long time. And I know he was early into crypto. He just done a bunch of angel investing. And so I don't know exactly what the calculus was on his side, but I imagine the ability to operate autonomously, the quantum of the dollars that are here, the ability to make a lot of money for all his employees, to de-risk a lot of things. I'm sure a bunch of those things played a part in it. Now, why would Adobe do this? I think there were a lot of people that were the finance Twitter element of this. When I said this was a strategic acquisition, I don't know if anyone actually disputed the merits of the acquisition, but there were a lot of people that disputed the price. And so we alluded to this, or I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but the first thing is this is them admitting that they can't do what Figma's doing, which I think has become self-evident to anyone that sort of looked at the space over the course of the last 5 years, that Adobe wasn't going to be able to modernize their applications for a host of reasons that I kind of touched on earlier. But there's a bunch more, and there's good threads on and online if you hunt around on why it's really hard to take a single player product to multiplayer and all of that stuff. The other one that I think is just interesting is Adobe runs the risk of being obsolete, not just because of in this market, right? And Adobe has other products as well. But design is kind of the core of what Adobe does. And so if you look at there's two players that have been really chipping away at Adobe, and one is Canva, which is a business out of Australia, Melanie Perkins. I think their last round was done at something like $40 billion. It's more of a prosumer product, right? Focusing on an individual. If you're not a designer, you could log in and use that. And that's chipping away at Adobe's business. And then there's Figma, which is more of the B2B version of it, right? And Figma's last round was $20 billion. And so if I'm Adobe, if I'm sitting there and I'm saying, hey, I'm getting hit on two flanks, one at the individual kind of prosumer level, one at the B2B more enterprise level, I would be thinking about what the acquisition could be to do if I wasn't able to build this stuff internally. And I think it was pretty clear they couldn't. If people didn't like Adobe paying $20 billion for a company, 2x the last round that Figma got done at, I imagine they wouldn't like, they wouldn't love Adobe paying whatever it would have cost to acquire Canva's business. And so I don't know this, but my guess is that just the magnitude of dollars it would have taken probably led them in more of Figma's direction. But I don't know. I don't know exactly what the inputs into that were. But the thing is, and as everyone sort of debated, like, oh, is this overpaying? Is this underpaying? I've seen people call this Adobe's Instagram. I've seen people say that there's no way they're ever going to make this valuation accretive. The reason that I think it's strategic is that Adobe, if they don't do stuff like this, they really run the risk of just slowly moving into a mature, very low growth, cash flowing company. And those are valued very, very different than the high growth kind of exciting things with big prospects in the future. And so taking a bet like this on a leader, one, taking out a competitor, but two, taking a bet like this on a leader that's built a product in the way that Dylan has in their core market that can help modernize but also future-proof Adobe within one of their core competencies, it seemed like something of a no-brainer to me from their vantage point. Now, I imagine they started throwing up more and more as the price kept going up and the market kept going down. I would have to think they started at some number that wasn't $20 billion and the market kept sliding down and Figma kept asking for more. That would be my guess. And so there was probably some breaking point where they were going to be willing to walk away and just keep at it here. But I think it's really impressive to me from the Adobe team and a testament to them that they were actually able to get this done, able to take this level of risk, willing to pay out that amount of money and take the stock price hit that they did. We'll see, right? Obviously, this thing's going to play itself out and people are going to scrutinize whether or not it was a good acquisition or not. Figma's going to need to execute really well within Adobe. A $16.5 billion TAM is really impressive, and growing from 200 to 400 in ARR, cash flow positive, 150% net retention, all that stuff is amazingly impressive. And that's why it's one of the most special private software companies that has ever existed, right? But we're talking an order of magnitude of dollars that Adobe's going to want to see return on, right? And I don't know how many, now with the market turning, how many public software companies are north of $20 billion, but it's not a ton, right? It's, I don't know, it's 10 SaaS companies, 8 SaaS companies. It's Workday, it's Atlassian, it's Snowflake, it's Salesforce, it's Adobe, right? It's Datadog, it's probably CrowdStrike, right? Maybe Zoom still, I don't know. But like, we're talking on one hand ish, maybe two hands, the number of businesses that look like this. And so Figma's just going to need to execute and probably expand outside of design. And I think they're going to do that with their whiteboarding product with FigJam. But they're also going to need to go do other stuff. And hopefully Adobe gives them the latitude and the resources to go do that. And hopefully Dylan's able to operate autonomously to execute on it. Really impressive, just story start to finish for all the investors involved. I know The index guys did the seed, Greylock the A, Kleiner the B, Sequoia the C, Andreessen the D. Kind of a who's who of who probably doesn't need wins, but good on all of them for making the bets that they did. And yeah, this is a historic outcome in software. Really impressive for Dylan, and hopefully we'll lead him to actually coming on the podcast, and we can talk through some of this stuff. So thanks everyone for listening. Now what you're going to hear next is Zach and I riffing about his documentary, and then we'll dive into an interview with Kate Ryder from Maven. He is back. Zach Weinberg, thank you for coming back on. How are we doing?
I'm good. I was on a 45-day vacation. It was great.
So you live this summer in the suburbs, right? So in the suburbs, you leave the city, and then you come back in the fall for you have two kids, right?
I have two kids, yeah.
For them to go back to school, I guess the older one and the younger one, just to get back to life in the city?
Yeah, they're actually both going to school now. The younger one's in school as well. And normally in the summer, we split time. This summer, we didn't make it back as much. I was there, you know, every so often. But yeah, we're back. We're definitely back full time now. And school starts in September. So we are back. To be clear, I was not on a 45-day vacation.
Yeah, exactly. For all the LPs that listen for the crypto takes.
I was just mostly on Twitter the whole time, just, you know, making bad jokes.
You were on a vacation from coming on this. I was blocked off. So now we have a few that we need to record.
I was on LP vacation schedule, which is I don't get anything done, but I did meet some very great LPs for us. So we're excited about it.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, it was a Herculean effort carrying this without you. Thankfully, Dick Costolo stepped in, which was helpful, and Rashad and all that. So you got back into the city and you found, I guess I want to touch on a little bit of the Twitter messiness that you found yourself in over the course of the last, I guess we're recording this on Tuesday late evening. So you found yourself in a little bit of Twitter messiness. So what happened when you got back into your Chelsea apartment?
Yeah, now I have to be like careful about what I say, I guess. So the actual story is I was taking my kids to school and with the hangout at school, because it was one of the like wean in days. And so our younger one was coming back early. So I was walking back home with him and my wife.
Younger one is four?
He's about to turn three.
Okay, about to turn three.
Yeah, the older one is still in class. And so we're walking back through Chelsea area, let's call it. And, you know, I mean, like, if you've walked through Chelsea, and this is in the middle of the day, right? This is like 10:30 a.m., 11 a.m. or so. It's definitely doesn't have the safest feel to it. I mean, there are clearly people on the street with mental health issues, and most, if not nearly all of the time, you know, it's not a safety risk that immediate moment, but then every so often it definitely feels that way. And then you read the news about various issues. Anyway, what actually had happened, that I didn't share this on Twitter because it was a little too odd to share, but on the way back, we were stopping. I was trying to take a picture of my wife and our younger son, because like first day of school stuff. And there is a guy in the background, like 30, 40 feet behind, who is just screaming at them and at me for taking this picture on the street, just like top of his voice, crazy screaming. He's actually, I'm not going to show the picture because I don't want to show this publicly, but I snapped the photo, you know, I'm like snapping the photos. And I can, if you zoom in on the photo in Google Photos, you can actually see him screaming in the background. Unfortunately, it was a photo and not a video, so I don't have the audio. And it was just like a few of those incidents where it's not, to me at least, like, there's a very clear issue with the safety of the streets and with not just like the cleanliness. It's okay, it's New York. Sometimes stuff gets dirty, like it's fine. But, you know, people peeing and defecating on the streets. There's clearly like drug use on the streets. And yes, not every interaction, not every person is unsafe. But it seems to me that clearly there is a core contingent of folks here that would be better off in a facility or somewhere that's not endangering the public. And, you know, we can argue about the fact that there's maybe not like a ton of great options out there, which is true. But this is the reality of the day, right? Like the lack of good options doesn't negate the fact that the issue exists right now. So I I guess, posted a little bit on Twitter because I had this idea to kind of record a day in the life, right? Like, not about singling out any one person at all. In fact, I think we eventually, when we're going to do this video, we'll blur our faces and things like that.
You are actually going
to
do it.
Yeah, I posted it on Twitter to find a videographer who would do this. And I had like 400 people DM. I haven't even gotten through the DMs. I haven't had time. I have like unlimited number of DMs from people saying, I see the same thing. There's a really big issue. I want to help document it. I mean, most people don't like to speak up in public because eventually they get canceled. And I guess I'm like post cancellation now, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, you are. You're welcome.
But on private DMs on Twitter, it's like amazing. I got like a tons of So I found this one kid who I will ask him if he's willing to share his name at some point, who's at NYU, who's going to help me put this video, this kind of like day in the life video together to show the volume and severity of what's going on, not just in Chelsea, but kind of like all across New York City.
No, and I've lived over the course of COVID. I was in Austin for a little while. I was in Miami. I was in Chicago. I was in San Francisco for a minute. And I was in New York, right? So I've sort of seen different, and it's clearly impacted a lot of major metropolitan cities. Like New York certainly isn't unique to this. I guess what I was most interested in is the reaction. So you posted, hey, can I find an NYU student to do this? And the reaction to it was interesting, right? There's kind of this like, I don't know. I mean, maybe you comment on like what were kind of the responses. Obviously you got a ton of positive DMs. There's a lot of people that see the same thing you do. Maybe some people that disagree with like the tactics of how to go about it or something. I don't know. But like, what were the responses that you got from people and like kind of the outrage that came out?
Yeah, I think there was all over the place, right? Like a ton of people saying this is a real issue and big public support. I got unlimited number of private messages, both direct and indirect, of thank you for speaking out because it's not something that I can do. I can't speak out because of fear for, you know, somebody getting on me for not being compassionate and losing my job and all this. So I think there's a little bit of private support. And then obviously there's the folks saying, you know, this is not your place. These are folks that have mental health issues. And, you know, there's economic issues in terms of sleeping on the street. Obviously, you know, New York is an extraordinarily expensive place to live. Have you no compassion? And I understand. I get it, right? Like, it is a shit situation. And to be clear, like sleeping on the street, and if you're dangerous, is illegal in New York City. And whether you agree with that or not, it is the case. And I am intimately aware that there is not a bunch of great options for people who have the, you know, this issue at hand, whether it's true mental health issues or addiction issues, or they just are like down on their luck, as you know, so a smaller subset. I mean, I think many do have mental health and addiction issues, but it doesn't change the fact that it's happening. And like, that's the part that I think is really difficult to argue with, where people are like, yeah, but it's not fair. And I guess my whole point is like, I understand it's not fair, but it's also not fair to the people who have to deal with the safety issues, in particular people who have kids. It's not fair to them as well. And so by saying it's an issue that you shouldn't go, you know, create awareness for and pursue some sort of like change that you'd like to affect, what you're effectively saying, at least in my opinion, is you're okay with the status quo. Right? You're prioritizing the one issue over the other. You're saying, well, I don't have a better idea, but I don't like yours. And what I kept asking people, and I continue to do this, I like to argue with folks who have at least like reasonable opinions, is I understand you don't like the idea of enforcing the laws in this case. I get it. It's not a great answer. Please tell me another idea that can actually be done in the next 24 months that has some sort of like underlying true impact at any reasonable scale. And most of the answers are, well, it doesn't work that way. You have to lobby politicians. And I get, yeah, there's like a whole bunch of long-term stuff I would love to do. I'd love to build housing in every place humanly possible. I've been a giant advocate for housing abundance and getting rid of crazy zoning laws that are regressive. But the reality is the situation is here right now. You may not like the solutions, but by doing nothing, in my opinion, you're endorsing the status quo and you're comfortable with it getting worse. And we've all seen those videos out of San Francisco. They're not great.
Yeah.
I don't want New York to turn into that situation. By the way, when it happens and you have people leave, then your tax revenue goes down, then you actually have less money for the social services, and you end up making it harder to solve problems because you shoot yourself in the foot economically. Like the whole thing doesn't make any sense to me when you're like, well, we shouldn't do, you know, X, Y, and Z in terms of law enforcement. It's like, what do you expect to happen if things go the other way? The situation will get worse. And sometimes reality is messy. That's kind of my takeaway. Reality is messy.
So is your hope in documenting this that people just aren't aware that this is going on and to the extent it's going on? And so in documenting, I guess, to what end, right? And so I'm sure you can capture a lot of like fascinating footage on it. But is it that, hey, this is a serious problem, and if we don't act on it and enforce laws, then this is going to spiral out of control? Is that sort of the end of this?
I think awareness isn't binary. I think there's this, you know, this aware, not aware, like that's just not how this works, right? Like people are aware of many things that they don't think are material or an issue. They've heard of it, they've seen it. And I think the reality of being a local politician or leader in New York City is you have a lot of shit on your plate.
Yeah.
Right. Like there's a lot of things going on. And so are you aware that we have, you know, like a safety issue and addiction issue on the streets of New York? Yeah, of course you're aware. You're also aware of 900 other issues that you're dealing with or potentially dealing with. And unless there is I don't want to say uproar because it's not the right term, but at least like a push from local citizens to say this is important and needs to be solved now, it's just going to be deprioritized.
Yeah.
And again, this argument about aware, everyone's aware. Okay, sure, they're aware, but they're doing nothing about it. And I think the reality of politics is like, people respond to pressure. They respond to phone calls. They respond to in-person visits. And I think they respond to visuals as well. So my goal is to say, this is not like a one-time isolated issue. It's not a random event. It's happening consistently across the city. I think some of the pushback was on this idea of like recording people.
Yeah. That was something I saw.
Yeah. Like, first of all, to be clear, in public, you do not have an expectation of privacy. With that said, this is not the idea, and I did probably a poor job of articulating this, is not to be like, hey, look at this person. It's to document, here are the type of things going on from a volume standpoint. And so we'll make sure to do our absolute best to not highlight any one person and to blur faces where relevant and necessary. It's not about look at this person. It's about look at this situation and the consistency of that situation. The number one thing I learned in all this, I like to hear the pushback. It's always interesting. I think it makes you better at arguing your case because you know what people are going to come back with. The number one thing, at least to me, that I was shocked by was how many people were like, I don't like your solution, which was to enforce the law and to take people off the streets, to be honest, like especially those with mental health and addiction issues who eventually become safety risks. And people don't like that. And so I'd say, fine, I don't love doing that idea either, but give me an alternative. And then the answer is usually, well, here's these like either lobbying efforts you should do for some future solution that's not going to happen for 5 to 10 years. So like, that sounds great, but it's not a reality today. I would love to support XYZ, but it's going to take forever. Or, you know, donate money to some local charity or to something, which I'm happy to do. I'm happy to donate money, but the impact that my $10,000 or $50,000 has on a scale of issue across the entire city is a blip.
Yeah.
It's like people are just bad at the sizing of this. Like, sure, we can give a little bit of money to this group or a lot of money to this group, but that is not going to fix the core issue. That is a Band-Aid on a wound that's gushing blood.
Yeah.
And so like, come back to me with better ideas and I would love to pursue them. But I think, look, you're pressed to make a difficult choice and it's a, you know, picking between the worst options and people just don't want to face reality of the situation. And then what that, and sorry for the long ramble here, but what that means is if you're like, okay, if you're not comfortable with a solution of like enforcing the law and keeping people safe today, then in a sense, you're kind of embracing the status quo and saying it's okay.
Yeah. And right? It's clearly going in one direction. At a personal level, Tori, my fiance, was chased four blocks. It was like 24th and 3rd to 28th and 3rd, was like chased down the street and had to sprint and run into her sister's apartment complex, and the doorman had to like barricade the door and block. So like, you know, whatever. One anecdote is not a great way of like proving a point, but it did at a personal level, it happened, right?
And everybody in New York has that story, either directly or indirectly through a friend. And I am all for advocating for those that can't advocate for themselves. If there is a viable solution that is available in the short run to actually do something. And unfortunately, we don't really have that at any scale right now. And so we have to consider other options, which I do think is, in a way, cleaning up the streets. And that is, my hope, at least for these, the video, is to generate awareness so that the politicians have to do something. I have learned through entrepreneurship that sometimes it just takes one or two crazy people with a little bit of gumption and the willingness to do the stuff that nobody else wants to do to like affect change. Is that going to be me and this NYU student recording a video? Probably not, but I'm going to try because like it's the only thing I've ever done is just say, fine, no one else wants to do it. I'll do it. I'll do the annoying problem and kind of works.
Listen, it's a noble, it's something I haven't seen it to the extent, minus that one anecdote. I guess I'm in San Francisco currently, and having been here, the order of magnitude feels certainly more severe here than it does in New York. And I think when you notice this stuff, there's a need to like, to what end, right? Like what? And so I guess for me to date, I've just been like, gosh, that sucks. I hope someone fixes this. And I have to think the majority of New Yorkers are kind of in that bucket, right? No one likes this, right? The people that like it are not the people that are living on the street and impacted by it, right? They're the ones that are like not in danger of the situation happening. And so I guess I appreciate people doing things, right, and trying, and just it's hard enough with the calcification that exists in government for anything to fucking happen. And so I don't know about this as a tactic. I remember Kony 2012 back in the day, like one video that was ridiculous, right? And that guy ultimately went insane. But like these things can be impactful and elicit change. And so it's like, I don't know. It's interesting how you get characterized as this rich tech executive trying to do NIMBYism or whatever, right? When it's like, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but at least it's someone trying.
Ironically, I'm the biggest YIMBY, they would say, out there. I've been advocating to build housing for years, right? Like, yeah. To me, the NIMBYism is the people saying, well, that's your problem, deal with it. And it's like, you're basically agreeing. I think of NIMBYism as like, you promote the status quo and you don't want anything to happen. You're comfortable with the way things are.
Yeah.
And to me, the biggest NIMBYs are the ones saying, let the streets, you know, kind of react and look the way they are and let it get worse because we're uncomfortable doing anything. It's the same thing as the person who's like, we're uncomfortable putting up this new building that's going to generate net new housing because some developer makes a little bit of money. It's like, you can't like have your cake and eat it too in this situation. Like the world works in a certain way. And unfortunately, it's that magical thinking again, right? It comes back. It's the same stuff as crypto. Imagine a world and you're like, oh yes, I too can like imagine a world where there is unlimited housing and it's really cheap because we built it everywhere. Sounds fucking great. It doesn't exist.
It was pretty funny. Someone replying, and I couldn't tell if they were being tongue in cheek or not, but when I was joking with you about this on Twitter, someone responded and they're like, I'm having a real hard time pinning Zach's ideological views into one political party or the other. And I couldn't tell if they were being tongue-in-cheek or not, but your response is like, yes, it's almost like I form my own opinions on stuff or something, which is interesting.
Shockingly, I will think through an issue and decide if I agree with any party at any time. I will generally still vote Democratic. I do want to be clear. I appreciate like the system of the United States actually functioning and to spread my views on a podcast. I do think we have some right-wing actors that are like a threat to democracy. And that's, I don't think that's like a political opinion about, I believe in this or that. I would like, I'd hope.
Listen, if you're undermining the election right now, like, safe to say that's a threat. Like, yes, there's crazy people on both sides for sure. Right. One is trying to undermine the system of democracy right now. And so that to me is a little crazier, but sure.
I think I've maybe broke some hearts. People like, I thought you were a liberal. And I'm like, I am generally a liberal thinking person, but I also enjoy my kids having safe passage to school. And I am willing to say that, like, I value the safety of my kids and the other people in the neighborhood more than I value somebody's right to sleep on the street. I'm sorry, I do.
Yeah.
And I think most people do. And they're just like a little uncomfortable saying that. Like, sometimes you have to make a choice and it's not great for everybody. And I think we have to make that choice in this context, and not everybody has to agree with me.
Good. Well, nodding along, I'm sure we'll get me dragged into this with you as well, but I appreciate you doing something here, and yeah, hopefully we can figure this out.
You're the Steve Bannon for this issue behind the scenes or something.
That's right. Most issues I am, but yeah, this one specifically.
All we have to do is launch a little fundraising scheme and here we are.
Yeah, exactly. SPACs are the best way to that.
Didn't he get arrested for that again?
I think so.
Like New York, just yeah.
I sort of get all the like Trump operatives arrested for like, you know, nefarious campaign laws or whatever, or like wire fraud or what racketeering or something. Like I get all of them confused. But yeah, I think Bannon got arrested for something too. Kate Ryder, thank you for coming on to talk to Zach and I.
Thanks. Excited to be here. I've heard so much about you, Logan, for years.
I know. Kate, maybe I can give my quick context, but my now fiance, Tori, who we referenced last week, is what? She's been at Maven now for 3 years. I guess she joined right around the time we started dating. So I can almost time it exactly when she joined. And then we lived in your house at the very beginning of the pandemic, which is a weird to meet over a video podcast right now when I lived in your house in the middle of the pandemic. So I appreciate you doing this. I'm glad everyone got to see live our actual meet and greet here.
Yeah, no, totally. It was I remember that. Yeah, we left in a rush. I think it was like March 12th, 2020, and then you and Tori moved in a day later, because you're like, there could be looting. We don't know what's going to happen. Do you want to just live in this house? You would be doing us a favor. And it was awesome that you guys did that.
It worked out. It's a wonderful place. I know exactly where you're recording. I think that was my office in the middle of the pandemic for about 3 weeks or so. And this was, I guess, middle of March, end of March 2020. So kind of a bleak period in the world. And so I it's a wonderful home, and I am very thankful that you allowed us to do that. But weird memories associated with sitting there and working on that exact table you're sitting at now.
And would you have ever thought that two and a half years later you'd be engaged to Tori and we'd be doing this podcast? You hadn't started this podcast, right?
I know. You know, I, as a young boy, I aspired to have a podcast, and I think every white man named Logan's dream is like to have a podcast one day, and so thankfully it came to fruition for me. And then actually, funny enough, Zach and I we had only met over video, and we actually met last week in person, and he told me I gave off much shorter energy over video, and I'm far taller than he expected in person. So, that was an interesting kind of like backhanded insult. I wasn't exactly sure how to take that.
I just assumed you were like a tiny little man with big internet opinions. And it turns out you're actually extraordinarily tall and you're still have big internet opinions, actually. So my assumptions were all wrong.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's an interesting. We had a fun time on Thursday night, Zach. Zach, hopefully you enjoyed yourself. Our first. I'm sorry we weren't able to actually get video footage of it. I think that's something we probably could have NFT'd out or something. Us actually meeting for the first time.
Probably for the best. After us having like a few drinks together, I don't think we want to be recording ourselves at that point.
I think that's probably right. I think about the time Aaron Levy walked in and you said, "Oh, it's the big Jew himself." I think that was probably no longer do we want any recording footage of what transpired after that.
I'm glad you remember that moment, because until 2 minutes ago, I didn't.
Yeah, no, that was a notable moment in my I don't think Levy knew exactly how to respond to that. But Kate, thank you for doing this. And I guess you guys know each other through just Healthcare New York. Is that right?
Yes. And Zach gave one of the best lunch and learns to our company right before COVID hit. So it was one of the last in-person lunch and learns in 2019, which was great. So good to be together again, Zach.
I remember clearly, I remember talking to the team. You had a bunch of people ask very good questions. And then I left. And I remember thinking on my way back, I think I was probably going to the Flatiron offices. Why did I not ask to invest? I can't remember exactly what was going through my head. I might have been distracted, but that was definitely a regret of mine, not walking out of the room without some allocation in your last or next round. So my bad on that.
Well, you can't get them all, Zach. You've had a good run. So it's nice. Whatever angels actually snuck their way into that, it's nice for you to save some for the rest of us. But maybe, Kate, just about lead off and give people kind of an overview. Can you give us the quick version of your foray into being the founder CEO of Maven, and then a little bit about what Maven actually does?
Sure. So I always knew I wanted to start a company right at the time when I realized that journalism wasn't going to be my long-term career. I was living in Singapore and tried to start my first business off the back of one of my one of the stories I was writing, actually about the Chinese travel industry. So although that never took off, it definitely made me really excited to one day kind of do it. And my dad, who was an entrepreneur, he gave me a piece of advice at the time, which was, you know, that this sounds like an interesting idea, and I think you'd be a good entrepreneur, but go learn on somebody else's dime first. And so I got a job in venture capital. My husband and I ended up moving to London. I got a job in venture capital, worked in London for 2 years, and then launched Maven off the back of that. So it was a kind of winding path, and there was lots of learning along the way, and it, particularly in the 2 years of venture capital, but really obviously excited where we ended up, and very one of the best pieces of advice I got at Index was start something that you're passionate about, and that you're, you know, if you're doing still doing this job in 10 to 15 to 20 years, that you still care about the problem. And so women's and family health, I still care about that problem, and unfortunately it's getting worse, not better.
So maybe tell us a little bit, you alluded to it there, but what does Maven do today? Where did it start at? What was the like insight you had back then, and then what are you up to today?
Sure. So Maven is the largest virtual clinic in women's and family health. And so we have a virtual care platform that starts with preconception care and goes through menopause now. We just launched that this year. And the core insight, 8 years ago when I started was, you know, the digital health industry was kind of at the end of the first inning. And there's some interesting companies, particularly in primary care and telemedicine and tracking. And there's this common theme that, that women were the dominant consumer and that they were all trying to crack digital patient engagement. And one of the, you know, it was right around the time that my best friend had a child. She was the first of our friend group to have a kid. And her experience and then the subsequent experiences of my friends and then my own experiences, I have three kids today. It was just eye-opening how women were really at the center of the healthcare system, and yet this one moment, the beginning of a family and growing a family, was so massively underserved. There's a huge business case to be made for it, and so you know, I thought, wow, this is something. If changing this is something that takes me 10 to 15 to 20 years, but we really can do something here and shape the entire healthcare industry to be a little bit more designed for women and families. That would be an amazing opportunity. And so 8 years later, we're still at it.
You mentioned digital patient engagement or digital engagement broadly. Can you define that? Because I always hear that term tossed around, and I think it's used differently by different people. So how do you think about it, and how might that differ from just going and seeing your regular doctor or OB in this case?
Sure. So the way we think about it today is we have a digital experience in the various programs that we have. And so we look at both touch points. So that's, you know, how many times, and we have different touch points. So how many times somebody's opening the app to, you know, the content reads, the virtual classes they go to, the varying levels of engagement with our community and content products. Then all the way into how many times are they engaging with their care advocate and their navigator, all the way up to and how many times they're actually using the telemedicine, you know, booking appointments with providers. So we kind of have a hierarchy of digital engagement. I think at the time, though, 8 years ago, it was just like trying to get people to engage, period. And still today, I think you're right. A lot of companies define engagement differently. We define it like a consumer app because we're B2B2C product. And so the only way we're going to be successful is people are using us like they would use any consumer product.
Kate, so originally you started, though, consumer facing. Was the ultimate, so as I understand it today, because I quasi, I could probably give your sales pitch having lived with someone for 2 years that has been an employee. So I guess as I say, as I think about it, which I think I have a pretty good understanding, but you started originally consumer facing and then went B2B and then employer. Was that like a purposeful insight that consumer is where to start with all of this, or was that like an evolution of trying to understand the distribution methods of how to actually serve these people, ultimately employers and therefore payers, was like the way to actually go about doing it?
Yeah, sure. Good question. So now there's a term for it. I didn't really know the term when we were doing it, but I guess it's called B2C to B, you know, go to market in healthcare. And the rationale in plain speak at the time was if the best way we're able to drive real clinical outcomes and prove that our care model is the better care model for patients than what they have today, then we have to have the best consumer product. And so let's go kind of learn and try out the consumer market. They're in some ways like they're the biggest critics. You know, any consumer, if they're not liking something, they're going to put the product down. And then also because at the time in this was 2014, 2015, 2016, a lot of investors didn't, weren't really, they didn't really understand digital health yet. And so we also had to show momentum in a way that, selling to employers just took a longer time. And so I definitely leaned heavily on some other digital health founders and friends who were taking the same route at the time. So TJ Parker from PillPack is one of them, you know, where they built a consumer product, but then they had to go get those pharmacy licenses in all the various states. And then, and then they were starting to sell through the B2B channels. But, Sean Duffy at Omada, very, very similar. So it was. It ultimately proved to be the right go to market. I just think I did not know it was going to take so long. Now in hindsight, we're lucky that we spent those years building a great product, because now when the scale came, we were ready for it. But the first few years were a total grind.
And so the initial product that you launched with, was it like a doctor navigation tool for consumers? Was that what was like the original wedge that you got in with to actually get people using the product?
So the original thesis was all about access. So so much of what I observed in my friends and then my own experiences was, we were such uneducated consumers going into these big moments of, starting families, getting pregnant, going through IVF. And so we needed to meet way more types of providers who could support us. So there was mental health, nutrition, women's health, physical therapy, doulas, midwives. I mean, there are so many amazing providers in women's and family health that are not part of traditional reimbursement models. So one, it was, how do we provide access to all of those different types of providers and build this kind of holistic care team? And then two is, how do we do it in a way that's more modern than, waiting 3 weeks to go to the doctor? And so that was the on-demand telemedicine component. And so, that was the core insight. It wasn't necessarily async at that point. And we knew we had to go B2B. We were actually pitching our first B2B product, which was a maternity product, even before we launched the consumer product. But it was always very much about the care model itself. And how do you use technology to actually improve the underlying care model?
How did you think about, in terms of the content and then actually the clinical staff that the patients would, I always think patient, but that the members would ultimately get access to, and how that relates to their primary care doc or their OB and the interaction of, the questions they're asking and the actual doctor they're seeing in person?
Yeah, so the reality is when a lot of women get pregnant for the first time or go through IVF, they don't have an OB or a clinic. So we see that today in our data, but just kind of from, just a lot of conversations, it was very clear with my own personal experience as well. And then when you're going to an OB, sometimes you're seeing somebody, other times you're just in a practice. So you're not actually building those enduring relationships. And I think also that the in-person patient experience is you're only going once a month and you know, you might have 10 minutes with the doctor. And so much of IVF for pregnancy happens outside of those 10 minutes. And whether it's, you know, nutrition support, or you're managing a high-risk condition, or mental health, or just kind of career coaching, which is one of our more popular provider types. All of that are ways in which people are using Maven outside. And then we're complementing that in-person experience. And then postpartum, there was nothing. So that was also one of the core insights when we launched was, you know, everything stops right after the baby is born. There's no paid leave. At that time, like, a lot of people didn't have leave. There were no return to work programs. No health plan programs went beyond 9 months. None of the apps did. And so it was kind of like, we complemented that in-person care model during the 9 months of pregnancy. And then when postpartum hit, we actually were the core, the primary provider, because there was nothing else.
So the whole idea was to make sure that you were almost by design, in a sense, like complementary to the very specific but narrow, I guess, medical care you would see from an OB, where you have to be physically present and focus on all the kind of like supportive care and access challenges for, in a sense, everything else. Is that like a fair way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I would say there's a core prenatal model today. And that's this kind of, you go to the doctor once a month and you may know them well, you may not. And then you deliver in a hospital. And ours was, there's so many gaps around that core model. And then postpartum is like a large gap. Return to work, you know, 43% of new moms don't return to the workplace after having kids. That's a large gap that's not supported. And then even before that, you know, we launched our fertility product in 2017. The whole, you know, IVF, egg freezing, surrogacy adoption pathways were also not part of the traditional model. So there was not just the complement to the 9 months of pregnancy, but it was all of the things around that to really equalize the care.
Can I actually ask what you guys, Living Healthcare, probably, you know, it's probably intuitive to this, but like, I have health insurance through, you know, a payer, right? There's someone that provides me health insurance through RedPoint as an employer. Why is this, like, all of these things, and what are all of these things that, and we've touched on it throughout the discussion, but what are all these things that are like, above and beyond what I would actually get from my provider of health insurance through RedPoint? Like, why does this, and I know there's other businesses that have done well, Livongo acquired for whatever, tens of billions of dollars. And then there's Hinge Health, and there's a bunch of other benefit companies that have popped up. But like, why are these incremental things that exist at all? And I guess, why is women's health a unique one specifically, Kate?
I mean, in an ideal world, none of these benefits would exist because the your core health provider would cover it all. And so, you know, I think we don't live in an ideal world, which is why there's such a large and growing digital health industry. I think for our market specifically, what's really different and why we started with building the largest women's and family health telemedicine network is the wedge into the consumer experience is with primary care, with chronic disease management, with mental health. You know, a lot of that is getting patients to the right provider and helping them understand, you know, that match and giving them that high quality care. And often making it tech enabled, and, you know, that's more convenient and whatnot. But with us and with women's and family health, there's just parts of it that are not in the healthcare system in the first place. And so fertility is a perfect example of that. I would hope that maybe you now have fertility benefits through RedPoint, but, you know, a lot of the health plans don't cover it and haven't covered it. It's a huge driver in sales in the market. And then with maternity benefits, what's happening is a lot of companies see maternity as their top cost when it comes to healthcare spend. So if you think about a big Fortune 50 employer, and, you know, like 10 to 12% of their entire healthcare budget, which could be billions of dollars, is spent on maternity care. And then they have this big problem where a lot of women are not coming back to work afterwards. And they look at their maternity spend, and, you know, there could be high rates of NICU spend or high, you know, high C-section rates. And so that's an area where they want to better clinically manage it. And they also want to, you know, really help women transition back to work and be able to breastfeed when they go back to work. So again, there's like major gaps right there. And then moving into what COVID really exposed was how burnt out parents are and how managing your kids' health as a parent while managing your career is also just added stress and continuation of the journey. And so we also have a parenting and pediatrics product. And then menopause, which we just launched this year, that was another that was similar to fertility. There was just like nothing there, period. And employees have started to ask about it. And as a lot of these benefits leaders look for, you know, equitable benefits, and DEI is really important to them, you know, you kind of have to invest in these areas. So very similar to like the Hinges or the others, in that there's a major medical spend category here where they're trying to control costs, but different a little bit, where this is a huge DEI benefit in a way that maybe some of the other medical benefits are not.
And maybe for like a little history, and then Kate, I'd love to get your take on this. If you think of the way healthcare has been paid for, you know, most healthcare is reimbursed by an insurance company. We don't have to go into who pays for the actual underlying insurance, but, you know, it's meant to reimburse for medical care, right? Like it was designed around providing care by doctors, kind of the easiest way to think about this, for a very specific set of work that they would do. And in many cases, it's not like perfectly this way, but based on the amount of time that it would take and the complexity of what that doctor was doing. And you get these situations in healthcare where not everything is about the like specific medical care that the doctor is providing. There's like supportive care benefits all in, actually in women's health. This is probably one of the biggest areas where it's not just about, you know, the physical exam or the diagnostic procedure. There's like plenty of stuff around it, but our healthcare system was not really designed to pay for that stuff. And so you see employers having to pony up money for like extra benefits that the typical insurance plan just simply doesn't cover. And then you kind of combine it. And I don't, okay, this is, I'm curious what your take on this, but you know, the history of designing who gets paid for what and what's paid for by insurance is kind of negotiated by a panel of doctors with Medicare. And then it kind of like trickles down from there with the commercial insurance companies. And most of those doctors are basically like old white guys. And so you've seen like significant under reimbursement for women's health because the people sitting in the dark room deciding on what is covered and what isn't, what's medical care and what isn't medical care, are basically just like old men. And we're paying for that now downstream. At least that's been my impression. I'm not like super in the weeds on the exact codes.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think there was a very famous picture during the last administration where everyone's talking about maternity benefits. And there was this big, you know, debate like, oh my gosh, why should the average taxpayer have to pay for maternity benefits? And it was a room full of men and there was not a single woman in that room. and it was basically saying like, you know, only women should pay more for their health insurance and healthcare because they're the ones having the babies. And so I think, you know, that that point of view has certainly led to, I think, underfunded major underfunded areas and just enormous gaps in care. And I think we see it in the statistics. The United States has the worst maternal death rate among all peer nations and in the developed world. And that's actually increased during COVID by 21%, which is pretty horrifying. And when you look at C-section rates compared to, you know, what the World Health Organization would recommend in a country, like the U.S., we're 20 percentage points above that. When you look at, you know, just all of these stats compared against many, many other countries, I mean, we're just consistently last.
Hey, Kate, and so maybe like a specific one on that, because you bring it up and it's interesting to me. So like, as I understand it, at a very literal level, like there's these outcome related services that maybe my health insurance covers, right? And so one of those could be like pregnancy. But there's a lot of things that exist outside of pregnancy that could be preventative or educational or supportive from a benefit standpoint that would be helpful. That's not actually the childbirth. Like, and so I guess one, is that right? And two, you use the example of C-sections, which I think is an interesting one. And I would love for you to drill down on that, because as I understand it, C-sections are very easy for the doctor and very hard for the woman. And basically, because of how the incentives are structured, the doctors, we disproportionately lean on C-sections in our country because the doctors, it's predictable, they can get back out of the surgery room exactly when they want to, versus the randomness associated with a non-C-section childbirth, right? Can you touch on those two things just to expand on that point?
Yeah, I would think of it as like, what is the most surprising and yet important thing that insurance typically doesn't cover that you help with?
So I would say that the most surprising thing about what insurance doesn't cover is pretty much everything outside of your core OB visit. So whereas, you know, the technology in the labor and delivery rooms has gotten better and better, it's certainly much better than it was 100 years ago. There's just really obvious things like the way that doulas, that presence of a doula can reduce the C-section rate. And so at a population level, I mean, it would make sense to reimburse doulas. And you're starting to see some of that across the states. But, you know, that whole concept was just, even though the economics and the numbers just proved how important that would be, just not there. I think mental health, we still have a long way to go. 1 out of 5 women suffer from some kind of perinatal mental health issue. That's also not baked into reimbursement models and can lead to, you know, worse outcomes. And so, you know, things like this, like for instance, breastfeeding, higher breastfeeding rates is linked to lower rates of heart disease in women. That's a little bit longer term than just the short term, but heart disease is one of the top killers of women. And so you would think that like just little tweaks to the model would from a population level really actually drive better outcomes and reduce costs. And so none of that was being taken into consideration. And then even areas like miscarriage, 1 out of 4or 1 out of 5 pregnancies end in miscarriage, and there's just nothing there. And so that those are some examples of just, you know, fertility aside, like even in the core pregnancy episode, there's just so much that's not covered. Women's health, physical therapy as well, pelvic floor. And then when it comes to C-sections, you look at some of the incentives then that as women are going through this experience and now they're in the healthcare system where there's, you know, tons of misaligned incentives. You know, the childbirth is the number one reason for hospitalization in the U.S. Lots of money is made on childbirth. And so there are things sometimes in hospitals where on the labor and delivery floor, they might have a rule where a woman can only labor for 8 hours and then they have to do the C-section because it's heads and beds, or, you know, or it could be the doctor's choice and the doctor's just trying to kind of get through a certain number of patients that day because they're paid more when they do the C-section versus just kind of a vaginal birth. And, you know, there are great doctors out there, and there are great hospitals out there, but there's also, not great doctors out there. And there are also rules in some of these hospitals that are to minimize medical malpractice versus do what's best for the patient. And so, you know, all of this is what, as a woman is going through, and a family too, I mean, a couple really, is going through this very vulnerable experience where it's not just your own health, but it's the health of the baby that you're, you know, bring into the world. Everything is just so cosmic all the time and so existential. And so to think that you're going through this big experience in a system that's actually not designed for you and sometimes is designed in ways that are not helping you, I think you just need such an advocate, and Maven is that advocate to help you through all of these decisions that you have to make.
from an economic model standpoint, so you sell through to an employer, and so the employer says, I have a employee population of X number of people. Some percentage of that are women. Some percentage of that are women who are likely to give birth in the next, you know, however many years. So this is like a target population is important to me. But unfortunately, my current insurance plan, of which as the employer, I'm paying the premium or some percentage of the premium, it's just not covered. So you come in and fill that gap. How do they pay for it? You don't have to give away the exact pricing, but like, how did you think about charging and pricing the benefit there, given it's on top of insurance that the employer is already at least contributing towards?
So we fit really nicely into the model of a lot, what a lot of chronic condition companies do and disease management companies, which is, you know, there are a certain number of pregnancies per year or a certain number of IVF journeys or, you know, surrogacy journeys. And so we just charge based on who utilizes the program. And so what we, what the employer is looking at is the spend affiliated with fertility, which is, you know, a lot of employers right now are starting to cover fertility period. And the average cost of an IVF cycle these days is almost $25,000. So a lot of employers are freaking out at the cost. One out of eight couples, you know, is infertile, and other, you know, 20% of millennials are in LGBTQ relationships. So they're like, wow, these could be really big numbers here. So that's number one. And then, you know, that leads into pregnancy, and pregnancy that's high risk that can be, you know, lead to complications. You could have, you know, $500,000 babies that are really driving up your medical spend. And so what employers are looking at is beyond just member experience. How do we take an area that could be, you know, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on their scale? And how do we put in a program that's going to help our patients and give them the best member experience, but also help us control our costs? And in the case of fertility, maximize the dollars that we're spending. Because in the fertility market, you don't want your people going through 3, 4, 5 IVF cycles. Ideally, it's only one because it works on the first try. And so they're thinking about that. And then they're thinking about just overall maternity costs, because more IVF leads to higher risk pregnancies.
Do you give them any sort, them being the employer, any sort of calculator savings model? Like, how much of this is I actually go into the weeds and model the data, because at the end of the day, it's a financial decision, and how much of this is, you know, I want to be a good employer for women, and this is a benefit I'm willing to pay kind of above and beyond, even if it isn't necessarily savings at the end of the day. It's actually, you know, net dollars out.
Oh, no, it's all modeling. So I think, I mean, if you're a really small company, you're doing this for talent attraction and retention. So you're probably not going to model out as much. But no. When you get into most, I don't know, 5,000 employees or more, you're modeling out the savings. And so, yeah, we have our ROI calculators and all of that.
I figured that was the answer. That's the thing that's always the most interesting to me, is we talk a lot about the gaps in care and more from like a medical and outcome standpoint, like what we would want people to have. But actually, at the end of the day, you end up having to prove there's real financial savings, even if that gap is material and kind of like ethically an issue. It still comes down to a financial decision by, I assume, what, the benefits group and the CFO? Who's typically making the call?
Yeah, it's usually benefits. And, you know, I think that what has been really cool to see is some of these benefits leaders, if you think about it, like, they're, a lot of them are women, and they're looking at this not just for cost savings. So it's not like, oh my gosh, I'm going to, you know, remember that as some of the highlights of my career, putting in that awesome musculoskeletal benefit, like really important, obviously, but like, not like, wow, I'm going to remember this forever. This is like, I am improving society. I am doing something that I wish I had access to. I look at these under-supported moms around the office, or these, you know, the LGBTQ community that's just been left out of all of these care models, and I'm going to fix that. And so that's super cool. And I think what makes Maven almost, you know, it's a double bottom line. It's truly, not only is it attacking spend and driving better clinical outcomes, but it truly is changing things in the way that our, you know, our system and our government is not.
this is kind of a probing question, but if it didn't save money and it actually cost money to provide kind of this extra benefit, do you think people would still buy it? And how, like, at what price, how much would this have to be a premium on top before people would, like, seriously hesitate?
Well, I think if that was the case, you would just be limited to the employer market that is really competing for talent. I think with us, I mean, we have so much growth through payers, and it's the payers that are the real unlock and open up, you know, the entire employer market, and the folks, then they have fully insured and they have Medicaid. And so, you know, we can work in all of those markets because of this. And I think to your, you know, I think there would, there's a bunch of companies out there. It's probably an answer to your question where, you know, they can maybe sell into Fortune 100s that are really competitive on talent, and then, you know, small tech companies or whatnot, but they don't really grow beyond that.
Kate, one, I guess at a personal level, so you started this company when you were married, but no kids. Is that right?
Correct.
And now you have three. How has that informed, like, I mean, you've been a user of the product through three different pregnancies and after. Like, how has that informed product design or decisions? And can you just talk a little bit about what it's like to actually have lived the product three times through?
Yeah, and more. I mean, I actually started, I had a miscarriage before I even had a viable pregnancy. So that was my first experience, and very kind of unexpected accidental pregnancy and then a miscarriage. And so, you know, that's an example where we were the first product to have miscarriage as part of our core prenatal care model. And I think it's something that our team and certainly some of our clients really, really love. I remember actually one of the first clients, staff that we signed up in 2016 or 2017 had a member of their benefits team going through a miscarriage, and they wanted to launch us early. And we were like, we actually have a product for that, which is very cool. I think I have, each pregnancy has been really different. And I truly believe that it's so important to live the experiences. It's made me a better founder. There's still so much I don't know on so many different of our pathways that I rely on tons of, you know, interviews with people who have gone through it. You know, we're doing tons of Medicaid roundtables at the moment to understand the Medicaid experience while being pregnant. But, you know, just thinking about specific product features, you know, the whole, I think the actually one thing that it really did, I've had to have some real grit to get this business off the ground. I mean, we almost failed multiple times in the beginning. I think because I was using my own product and I knew that it was helping me a lot. I mean, particularly even through the miscarriage, I talked to like six different providers on Maven to process it because they give you no information in the system, and kind of worked it through there. And then for my first pregnancy, I mean, I think all first-time moms are freaked out about everything. And the third is totally fine. But anyways, I was going through it and having things happen to me, like getting carpal tunnel syndrome, which is like a, you know, your hands and arms are tingly, and getting a sciatica where, you know, it's hard to walk. And going to my doctor and getting nothing. And she's an amazing doctor. She's like, I don't know who to refer you to because I don't know who's in your network. And then finding I had no physical therapist in my network to help, or, you know, the toughness of going back to work, the toughness of breastfeeding that first time. I mean, as I was using it, it was just validating everything that we were building and giving us more resolve to just keep going. Because I think, you know, there was always the capital needs and would be able to kind of extend the runway until this business really took off. But I think we always knew, and I always knew, we were solving something that no one else was doing. And it was really, really important and helpful. And, you know, finally, thank God, it took off.
It's interesting. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, kind of related to all of that. So you've been on both sides of this table, right? You were on the fundraising side, and then you were fundraising. I'm curious. I mean, you saw some of the tricks of how VCs operate, right? How did that, I guess, what's it been like to be on both sides of the table, and where did you have more empathy from trying to understand the fundraising process as a founder that had previously been a VC? Was that able to augment, you know, how to run a process or some of the advisors that you brought in or anything like that to make it easier? It sounds like maybe not, given you said there was a few failures along the way and having to get through it, but interested in how that informed things for you.
I actually think it didn't prepare me as much as I would have thought. I understood term sheets and I understood, and I had an incredible network coming out of Index, and a lot of the, you know, some of the partners there and a lot of the entrepreneurs in their network invested in Maven. I was always super tight with Rich Lee, their amazing lawyer who was, you know, helping in the early days on term. So I understood that part. But what I didn't understand was when you are running a process, you need to drive a process, and it needs to be that you need to elicit some kind of FOMO, particularly in the early rounds. I mean, now it's kind of nice because it's like, hey, here are numbers. Yeah. But you know, in the Series A or the Series B, I mean, it was, I think the mistake I made in the seed and then the A, and it was a founder friend took me aside and was like, this is what a process looks like. And he was like, that, you know, you do this and then you do this and you talk to this person and, you know, you never reveal your cards. And it's actually the opposite of operating. Like when you're operating, you're trying to move fast, be transparent, get to a quick decision. And fundraising, it's like a little dance that you're doing. And investors are trying to sniff all the time. Is this a competitive deal? And, you know, and I get it. They're operating with very little information, but, you know, particularly at the A or the B, but it was, I switched how I did things and I got some real coaching for the Series B. And that was the round where, I mean, we had signed some big deals at that point. So we did have, Series A was just pure vision, but the Series B was we had some great early traction, but it was still vision. And I understood at that point how to run a process. So we did get multiple term sheets versus, you know, in previous rounds, it was rough. That was definitely, I couldn't believe it, that the entrepreneurs in the background before they were showing up at the partner meetings of the fund I worked at, they were just wheeling and dealing with all of these investors. And it's not just a game to get a term sheet, but it's a game around, you know, what the valuation's going to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sorry you got stuck with such tier two funds like Sequoia and that Series B. So it feels like you ended up doing okay, all things considered. It's interesting. I mean, I actually think people now, you were going through that in what, 2018, right? I almost think today, or at least over the last 2 years, it almost got like a little too contrived and the lack of authenticity. Like all the lessons that founder taught you, I think they probably posted them on some forum somewhere because everyone learned all the same lessons of like trying to create FOMO and all of that. And it led to like this transactional lack of like, I don't know, authenticity at times when people took it to its furthest extreme of like trying to build this momentum and all of that. And so I actually saw it go the other way of just like almost too much of that element of like prescriptive fundraising. So
The market crashed. So there we go.
Yeah, exactly. And then the market crashed. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I was going to ask, like, what's your take on this market in particular in terms of like previous valuation expectations and multiples that people were paying relative to where you think it's going? And this market primarily being defined as like employer benefit as opposed to more niche and kind of like direct competitors, but the broader employee benefit market.
Yeah, I think about it less as like who your buyer is, because, you know, it could be payers, whatever. And I think it feels to me it's more about are you just a healthcare services business with a little bit of tech enablement, or are you a true technology company? And I think if you're a true technology company operating within healthcare, you can get a lot more scale, leverage, margin, true innovation when it comes to delivery, care model, and all of that. And I just don't think that the first wave of companies that IPO'd really were true tech companies or are true tech companies. You know, I think that when COVID hit, you saw a bunch of, you know, there's such a stickiness in this industry that once you sign some of these big deals, like it's pretty hard to kick you out. There's inertia, there's a million competing priorities. But I think when COVID hit and then some of these companies, made even further strides, they were never scaling in a way that, you know, their underlying unit economics were just getting better and better over time. And I also think that they weren't able to be as nimble and personalized, I think, as a lot of the tech should be to really drive that engagement and outcomes as they could have been. And so anyway, so I think that I'm excited for the next wave of digital health companies to go public, and maybe, you know, we'll probably be in that pack. And it's kind of, you know, really showing the market actually, you know, those companies, they did a lot of great work. They were kind of, they paved the way, but they weren't necessarily the companies that are going to be the enduring ones.
I want to ask just kind of a question that I think is very unique to your business, in that there's been a handful of like lightning rod societal events that have sort of occurred during your tenure running Maven. I guess most notably Roe v. Wade being overturned at the Supreme Court. And I can imagine there's elements of that that are drawing a ton of attention to women's health and benefits like this, right? At the same time, I'm sure it's also traumatizing to a large portion of your members, as well as employees, right? And so it's kind of this unusual thing where I can imagine this is driving, in some ways, tailwinds for the business and the need for a service like yours, or the attention paid to a service like yours. On the other, it's like this major societal event that a lot of people view as like one of the worst travesties to happen in the United States over the course of the last, 30 years, right? And so as a leader kind of going through that, can you just talk, I feel like it's so unique to your business, and you're so like maybe the only one that can really weigh in on something like this. How has it been to lead in that environment?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think it's been harder to lead at other times that are to me, this is very black and white, and that's helped. I mean, to me, abortion is healthcare. It always has been. It's, you know, it's one of the top surgeries that women get in women's health, period. It is, you know, like one out of five women will have an abortion by the time they're 45. So it's just part of healthcare, and sometimes it's a personal decision why you know, people have one. Sometimes it's a medical decision that's privately made between a doctor and a patient. And so leading through this has been simply, I think, ensuring that we have a clarity of thought and a message, and the message is really simple, and it's that. And I think now, as we look to continue to lead through it, I think it's really important to bring a lot of the data to the light around what this is going to do to maternal health outcomes. Like, for instance, in a lot of these states with all these trigger laws, they already have, you know, 2x more maternal deaths than states without the trigger laws. So you see a lot of these adverse outcomes, and it's only going to increase. But I think the thing that also is really interesting, and you know, the economics has been divorced almost from these policies, because, you know, we just saw, for instance, in a southern state, they woke up and they're like, oh my God, we're going to have 3,000 more high-risk pregnancies next year. We already can barely pay for the pregnancies we have. How on earth are we going to pay for this? And they're asking the federal government for money. And so I think that, you know, it's just the beginning. I know that SB8 has been in place in Texas for, you know, a while now, and the first SB8 babies have been born. And so they've been able to trace some of the outcomes. They've been looking at hospital level data on those families and those moms. And
Kate, SB8, can you elaborate on that just for people that don't know?
Sure. That was a law in Texas that went into effect that limited abortion to 6 weeks in the fall, in September of 2021. And that was kind of the case that everybody kind of, that was the writing on the wall for Roe v. Wade. You know, it's really sad. A lot of the maternal morbidity, which is the, you know, short and long-term complications that come with pregnancy, it's all preventable. And, you know, a lot of them have just way more adverse outcomes, hysterectomies, you know, just really long-term health complications for all of these women because they couldn't get the abortion. And there's also a lot of, in the provider community themselves, because the laws are so, in some of the bounty states, so punitive. And, you know, they're saying some, in some states, providers can go to prison. The providers don't know how to treat women with miscarriage, women with, you know, that really need that support. I mean, I personally, having had a miscarriage, cannot imagine going into the hospital and having people be afraid of me. And that's what's happening in all of these states. And when I really, really needed the care and I didn't know what was happening. So I just think, you know, and by the way, the other piece of data there that's just horrific is that already 50% of U.S. counties don't have an OBGYN. So they're called maternity care deserts. And it's in a lot of these counties where a lot of these more draconian laws are being put in place. And so, you know, provider shortages are expected there as well. So in the states that, you know, New York, California, where you can get full women's health care, it can be fine, but really it's terrible what's going to happen to so many women in all of these different states that restrict this access.
It's almost like it's just, we really haven't seen how bad this is going to get, right? It's super early in the cycle.
It's very early. And so I think going back to your question of leadership, you know, it's such a shame that it's so politicized, because this is, again, just healthcare. It's healthcare, core women's healthcare. And so I think it's just continuing to lead with data, because the data does, you know, presents a very, very bleak and dark picture across all fronts, you know, women's rights, economics, clinical impacts. I mean, society, children's health. I mean, it's all bad.
Yeah, it's sobering. Anything else on your side, Kate? This is fantastic. I really appreciate you bearing with our questions here and internet connectivity issues. Zach, anything on your side?
No, this is great. I mean, I think it's always interesting to see both the financial realities of, like, how do you build a business and how do you position value for the customer, but in a healthcare setting where it's not, at least in terms of, yeah, I think many people's outside perspectives, it's not just about the economics, but you have to actually be able to do both. You have to kind of win on the better care and win on the economics to be able to build, like, a venture scale business. And that's what's going on here. So it's pretty cool to say.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, so that'll do it for the 33rd episode of Cartoon Avatars. Thank you to Kate Ryder for coming on. Thank you to Zach Weinberg, per usual. And look forward to seeing everyone next week on the 34th episode of Cartoon Avatars. Have a good weekend, everyone.